using as privilege types the British and French experiences of and with the Near Orient, Islam, and the Arabs. In those experiences, I discerned an intimate, perhaps even the most intimate, and rich relationship between Occident and Orient. Those experiences were part of a much wider European or Western relationship with the Orient, but what seems to have influenced Orientalism most was a fairly constant sense of confrontation felt by Westerners dealing with the East. The boundary notion of East and West, the varying degrees of projected inferiority and strength, the range of work done, the kinds of characteristic features ascribed to the Orient, all these testify to a willed, imaginative, and geographic division made between East and West, and lived through during many centuries. In Chapter 2, my focus narrowed a good deal. I was interested in the earliest phases of what I call modern Orientalism, which began during the latter part of the 18th century and the early years of the 19th. Since I did not intend my study to become a narrative chronicle of the development of Oriental studies in the modern West, I proposed instead an account of the rise, development, and institutions of Orientalism as they were formed against a background of intellectual, cultural, and political history until about 1870 or 1880. Although my interest in Orientalism there included a decently ample variety of scholars and imaginative writers, I cannot claim by any means to have presented more than a portrait of the typical structures and their ideological tendencies constituting the field, its associations with other fields, and the work of some of its most influential scholars. My principal operating assumptions were, and continue to be, that fields of learning, as much as the works of even the most eccentric artist, are constrained and acted upon by society, by cultural traditions, by worldly circumstance, and by stabilizing influences like schools, libraries, and governments. Moreover, that both learned and imaginative writing are never free, but are limited in their imagery, assumptions, and intentions. And finally, that the advances made by a science like Orientalism in its academic form are less objectively true than we often like to think. In short, my study hitherto has tried to describe the economy that makes Orientalism a coherent subject matter, even while allowing that, as an idea, concept, or image, the word Orient has a considerable and interesting cultural resonance in the West. I realize that such assumptions are not without their controversial side. Most of us assume in a general way that learning and scholarship move forward. They get better, we feel, as time passes and as more information is accumulated, methods are refined, and later generations of scholars improve upon earlier ones. In addition, we entertain a mythology of creation, in which it is believed that artistic genius, an original talent, or a powerful intellect can leap beyond the confines of its own time and place in order to put before the world a new work. It would be pointless to deny that such ideas as these carry some truth. Nevertheless, the possibilities for work present in the culture to a great and original mind are never unlimited, just as it is also true that a great talent has a very healthy respect for what others have done before it and for what the field already contains. The work of predecessors, the institutional life of a scholarly field, the collective nature of any learned enterprise, these, to say nothing of economic and social circumstances, tend to diminish the effects of the individual scholar's production. A field like Orientalism has a cumulative and corporate identity, one that is particularly strong given its associations with traditional learning, the classics, the Bible, philology. Public institutions, governments, trading companies, geographical societies, universities, and generically determined writing, travel books, books of exploration, fantasy, exotic description. The result for Orientalism has been a sort of consensus. Certain things, certain types of statement, certain types of work, have seemed, for the Orientalist, correct. He has built his work and research upon them, and they, in turn, have pressed hard upon new writers and scholars. Orientalism can thus be regarded as a manner of regularized or orientalized writing, vision, and study, dominated by imperatives, perspectives, and ideological biases ostensibly suited to the Orient. The Orient is taught, researched, administered, and pronounced upon in certain discrete ways. The Orient that appears in Orientalism, then, is a system of representations framed by a whole set of forces that brought the Orient into Western learning, Western consciousness, and later, Western empire. If this definition of Orientalism seems more political than not, that is simply because I think Orientalism was itself a product of certain political forces and activities. Orientalism is a school of interpretation whose material happens to be the Orient, its civilizations, peoples, and localities. Its objective discoveries, the work of innumerable devoted scholars who edited texts and translated them, codified grammars, wrote dictionaries, reconstructed dead epochs, produced positivistically verifiable learning, are and always have been conditioned by the fact that its truths, like any truths delivered by language, are embodied in language. And what is the truth of language, Nietzsche once said, but a mobile army of metaphors, metonyms, and anthropomorphisms, in short, a sum of human relations, which have been enhanced, transposed, and embellished poetically and rhetorically, and which, after long use, seem firm, canonical, and obligatory to a people. Truths are illusions about which one has forgotten that this is what they are. Perhaps such a view as Nietzsche's will strike us as too nihilistic, but at least it will draw attention to the fact that so far as it existed in the West's awareness, the Orient was a word which later accrued to it a wide field of meanings, associations, and connotations, and that these did not necessarily refer to the real Orient, but to the field surrounding the word. Thus, Orientalism is not only a positive doctrine about the Orient that exists at any one time in the West, it is also an influential academic tradition. When one refers to an academic specialist who is called an Orientalist, as well as an area of concern defined by travelers, commercial enterprises, governments, military expeditions, readers of novels and accounts of exotic adventure, natural historians, and pilgrims to whom the Orient is a specific kind of knowledge about specific places, peoples, and civilizations. For the Orient, idioms became frequent, and these idioms took firm hold in European discourse. Beneath the idioms, there was a layer of doctrine about the Orient. This doctrine was fashioned out of the experiences of many Europeans, all of them converging upon such essential aspects of the Orient as the Oriental character, Oriental despotism, Oriental sensuality, and the like. For any European during the 19th century, and I think one can say this almost without qualification, Orientalism was such a system of truths, truths in Nietzsche's sense of the word. It is therefore correct that every European, in what he could say about the Orient, was consequently a racist, an imperialist, and almost totally ethnocentric. Some of the immediate sting will be taken out of these labels if we recall additionally that human societies, at least the more advanced cultures, have rarely offered the individual anything but imperialism, racism, and ethnocentrism for dealing with other cultures. So Orientalism aided and was aided by general cultural pressures that tended to make more rigid the sense of difference between the European and Asiatic parts of the world. My contention is that Orientalism is fundamentally a political doctrine willed over the Orient because the Orient was weaker than the West, which elided the Orient's difference with its weakness. This proposition was introduced early in Chapter 1, and nearly everything in the pages that followed was intended in part as a corroboration of it. The very presence of a field such as Orientalism, with no corresponding equivalent in the Orient itself, suggests the relative strength of Orient and Occident. A vast number of pages on the Orient exist, and they, of course, signify a degree and quantity of interaction with the Orient that are quite formidable. But the crucial index of Western strength is that there is no possibility of comparing the movement of Westerners eastwards since the end of the 18th century with the movement of Easterners westwards. Leaving aside the fact that Western armies, consular corps, merchants, and scientific and archaeological expeditions were always going east, the number of travelers from the Islamic East to Europe between 1800 and 1900 is minuscule when compared with the number in the other direction. Moreover, the Eastern travelers in the West were there to learn from and to gape at an advanced culture. The purposes of the Western travelers in the Orient were, as we have seen, of quite a different order. In addition, it has been estimated that around 60,000 books dealing with the Near Orient were written between 1800 and 1950. There is no remotely comparable figure for Oriental books about the West. As a cultural apparatus, Orientalism is all aggression, activity, judgment, will to truth, and knowledge. The Orient existed for the West, or so it seemed to countless Orientalists, whose attitude to what they worked on was either paternalistic or candidly condescending, unless, of course, they were antiquarians, in which case the classical Orient was a credit to them and not to the lamentable modern Orient. And then, beefing up the Western scholars' work, there were numerous agencies and institutions with no parallels in Oriental society. Such an imbalance between East and West is obviously a function of changing historical patterns. During its political and military heyday from the 8th century to the 16th, Islam dominated both East and West. Then the center of power shifted westwards, and now, in the late 20th century, it seems to be directing itself back towards the East again. My account of 19th century Orientalism in Chapter 2 stopped at a particularly charged period in the latter part of the century, when the often dilatory, abstract, and projective aspects of Orientalism were about to take on a new sense of worldly mission in the service of formal colonialism. It is this project and this moment that I want now to describe, especially since it will furnish us with some important background for the 20th century crises of Orientalism and the resurgence of political and cultural strength in the East. On several occasions, I have alluded to the connections between Orientalism as a body of ideas, beliefs, clichés, or learning about the East, and other schools of thought at large in the culture. Now, one of the important developments in 19th century Orientalism was the distillation of essential ideas about the Orient, its sensuality, its tendency to despotism, its aberrant mentality, its habits of inaccuracy, its backwardness, into a separate and unchallenged coherence. Thus, for a writer to use the word Oriental was a reference for the reader sufficient to identify a specific body of information about the Orient. This information seemed to be morally neutral and objectively valid. It seemed to have an epistemological status equal to that of historical chronology or geographical location. In its most basic form, then, Oriental material could not really be violated by anyone's discoveries, nor did it seem ever to be revaluated completely. Instead, the work of various 19th century scholars and of imaginative writers made this essential body of knowledge more clear, more detailed, more substantial, and more distinct from Occidentalism. Yet Orientalist ideas could enter into alliance with general philosophical theories, such as those about the history of mankind and civilization, and diffuse world hypotheses, as philosophers sometimes call them, and in many ways the professional contributors to Oriental knowledge were anxious to couch their formulations and ideas, their scholarly work, their considered contemporary observations in language and terminology whose cultural validity derived from other sciences and systems of thought. The distinction I am making is really between an almost unconscious and certainly an untouchable positivity, which I shall call latent Orientalism, and the various stated views about Oriental society, languages, literatures, history, sociology, and so forth, which I shall call manifest Orientalism. Whatever change occurs in knowledge of the Orient is found almost exclusively in manifest Orientalism. The unanimity, stability, and durability of latent Orientalism are more or less constant. In the 19th century writers I analyzed in Chapter 2, the differences in their ideas about the Orient can be characterized as exclusively manifest differences, differences in form and personal style, rarely in basic content. Every one of them kept intact the separateness of the Orient, its eccentricity, its backwardness, its silent indifference, its feminine penetrability, its supine malleability. This is why every writer on the Orient, from Renan to Marx, ideologically speaking, or from the most rigorous scholars, Lane and Sacy, to the most powerful imaginations, Flaubert and Nerval, saw the Orient as a locale requiring Western attention, reconstruction, even redemption. The Orient existed as a place isolated from the mainstream of European progress in the sciences, arts, and commerce. Thus, whatever good or bad values were imputed to the Orient appeared to be functions of some highly specialized Western interest in the Orient. This was the situation from about the 1870s on through the early part of the 20th century, but let me give some examples that illustrate what I mean. Theses of Oriental backwardness, degeneracy, and inequality with the West most easily associated themselves early in the 19th century with ideas about the biological bases of racial inequality. Thus, the racial classifications found in Cuvier's Le règne animal, Gobineau's Essai sur l'inégalité des races humaines, and Robert Knox's The Races of Man found a willing partner in latent Orientalism. To these ideas was added second-order Darwinism, which seemed to accentuate the scientific validity of the division of races into advanced and backward, or European Aryan and Oriental African. Thus, the whole question of imperialism, as it was debated in the late 19th century by pro-imperialists and anti-imperialists alike, carried forward the binary typology of advanced and backward, or subject races, cultures, and societies. John Westlake's Chapters on the Principles of International Law, 1894, argues, for example, that regions of the earth designated as uncivilized, a word carrying the freight of Orientalist assumptions, among others, ought to be annexed or occupied by advanced powers. Similarly, the ideas of such writers as Karl Peters, Leopold de Saussure, and Charles Temple draw on the advanced, backward binarism so centrally advocated in late 19th century Orientalism. Along with all other peoples variously designated as backward, degenerate, uncivilized, and retarded, the Orientals were viewed in a framework constructed out of biological determinism and moral political admonishment. The Oriental was linked, thus, to elements in Western society. Delinquents, the insane, women, the poor, having in common an identity best described as lamentably alien. Orientals were rarely seen or looked at. They were seen through, analyzed not as citizens or even people, but as problems to be solved or confined or, as the colonial powers openly coveted their territory, taken over. The point is that the very designation of something as Oriental involved an already pronounced evaluative judgment, and in the case of the peoples inhabiting the decayed Ottoman Empire, an implicit program of action. Since the Oriental was a member of a subject race, he had to be subjected. It was that simple. The locus classicus for such judgment and action is to be found in Gustave Le Bon's Les Lois Psychologiques de l'Évolution des Peuples, 1894. But there were other uses for latent Orientalism. If that group of ideas allowed one to separate Orientals from advanced civilizing powers, and if the classical Orient served to justify both the Orientalist and his disregard of modern Orientals, latent Orientalism also encouraged a peculiarly, not to say invidiously, male conception of the world. I have already referred to this in passing during my discussion of Renan. The Oriental male was considered in isolation from the total community in which he lived, and which many Orientalists, following Lane, have viewed with something resembling contempt and fear. Orientalism itself, furthermore, was an exclusively male province. Like so many professional guilds during the modern period, it viewed itself and its subject matter with sexist blinders. This is especially evident in the writing of travelers and novelists. Women are usually the creatures of a male power fantasy. They express unlimited sensuality. They are more or less stupid, and above all, they are willing. Flaubert's Kutchuk Hanem is the prototype of such caricatures, which were common enough in pornographic novels. For example, Pierre-Louis Aphrodite, whose novelty draws on the Orient for their interest. Moreover, the male conception of the world, in its effect upon the practicing Orientalist, tends to be static, frozen, fixed eternally. The very possibility of development, transformation, human movement, in the deepest sense of the word, is denied the Orient and the Oriental, as a known and ultimately an immobilized or unproductive quality, they come to be identified with a bad sort of eternality. Hence, when the Orient is being approved, such phrases as the wisdom of the East. Transferred from an implicit social evaluation to a grandly cultural one, this static male Orientalism took on a variety of forms in the late 19th century, especially when Islam was being discussed. General cultural historians as respected as Leopold von Ranke and Jakob Burckhardt assailed Islam as if they were dealing not so much with an anthropomorphic abstraction as with a religio-political culture about which deep generalizations were possible and warranted. In his Weltgeschichte, 1881-1888, Ranke spoke of Islam as defeated by the Germanic-Romanic peoples. And in his Historische Fragmente, Unpublished Notes, 1893, Burckhardt spoke of Islam as wretched, bare, and trivial. Such intellectual operations were carried out with considerably more flair and enthusiasm by Oswald Spengler, whose ideas about a Magian personality, typified by the Muslim Oriental, infuse Der Untergang des Abendlandes, 1918-1922, and the morphology of cultures it advocates. What these widely diffused notions of the Orient depended on was the almost total absence in contemporary Western culture of the Orient as a genuinely felt and experienced force. For a number of evident reasons, the Orient was always in the position both of outsider and of incorporated weak partner for the West. To the extent that Western scholars were aware of contemporary Orientals or Oriental movements of thought and culture, these were perceived either as silent shadows to be animated by the Orientalist, brought into reality by him, or as a kind of cultural and intellectual proletariat, useful for the Orientalist's grander interpretative activity, necessary for his performance as superior judge, learned man, powerful cultural will. I mean to say that in discussions of the Orient is all absence, whereas one feels the Orientalist and what he says as presence. Yet we must not forget that the Orientalist's presence is enabled by the Orient's effective absence. This fact of substitution and displacement, as we must call it, clearly places on the Orientalist himself a certain pressure to reduce the Orient in his work, even after he has devoted a good deal of time to elucidating and exposing it. How else can one explain major scholarly production of the type we associate with Julius Wellhausen and Theodor Noeldecker, and overriding it, those bare, sweeping statements that almost totally denigrate their chosen subject matter? Thus, Noeldecker could declare in 1887 that the sum total of his work as an Orientalist was to confirm his low opinion of the Eastern peoples. And like Karl Becker, Noeldecker was a Philhellenist who showed his love of Greece curiously by displaying a positive dislike of the Orient, which, after all, was what he studied as a scholar. A very valuable and intelligent study of Orientalism, Jacques Vandenbourg's L'Islam dans le miroir de l'Occident, examines five important experts as makers of an image of Islam. Vandenbourg's mirror image metaphor for late 19th and early 20th century Orientalism is apt. In the work of each of his eminent Orientalists, there is a highly tendentious, in four cases out of the five, even hostile vision of Islam, as if each man saw Islam as a reflection of his own chosen weakness. Each scholar was profoundly learned, and the style of his contribution was unique. The five Orientalists among them exemplify what was best and strongest in the tradition during the period roughly from the 1880s to the interwar years. Yet Ignaz Goldzier's appreciation of Islam's tolerance towards other religions was undercut by his dislike of Muhammad's anthropomorphisms and Islam's too exterior theology and jurisprudence. Duncan Black MacDonald's interest in Islamic piety and orthodoxy was vitiated by his perception of what he considered Islam's heretical Christianity. Karl Becker's understanding of Islamic civilization made him see it as a sadly undeveloped one. See Snouk Hurhonje's highly refined studies of Islamic mysticism, which he considered the essential part of Islam, led him to a harsh judgment of its crippling limitations. And Louis Massignon's extraordinary identification with Muslim theology, mystical passion, and poetic art kept him curiously unforgiving to Islam for what he regarded as its unregenerate revolt against the idea of incarnation. The manifest differences in their methods emerge as less important than their Orientalist consensus on Islam. Latent inferiority. Vandenbourg's study has the additional virtue of showing how these five scholars shared a common intellectual and methodological tradition whose unity was truly international. Ever since the first Orientalist Congress in 1873, scholars in the field have known each other's work and felt each other's presence very directly. What Vandenbourg does not stress enough is that most of the late 19th century Orientalists were bound to each other politically as well. Snouk Hurhonje went directly from his studies of Islam to being an advisor to the Dutch government on handling its Muslim Indonesian colonies. MacDonald and Massignon were widely sought after as experts on Islamic matters by colonial administrators from North Africa to Pakistan, and, as Vandenbourg says, all too briefly at one point, all five scholars shaped a coherent vision of Islam that had a wide influence on government circles throughout the Western world. What we must add to Vandenbourg's observation is that these scholars were completing, bringing to an ultimate concrete refinement, the tendency since the 16th and 17th centuries to treat the Orient not only as a vague literary problem, but, according to Masson-Ursel, as un ferme propos d'assimiler adéquatement la valeur des langues pour pénétrer les mœurs et les pensées, pour forcer même des secrets de l'histoire. I spoke earlier of incorporation and assimilation of the Orient, as these activities were practiced by writers as different from each other as Dante and D'Herbelot. Clearly, there is a difference between those efforts and what, by the end of the 19th century, had become a truly formidable European cultural, political, and material enterprise. The 19th century colonial scramble for Africa was by no means limited to Africa, of course. Neither was the penetration of the Orient entirely a sudden, dramatic afterthought following years of scholarly study of Asia. What we must reckon with is a long and slow process of appropriation by which Europe, or the European awareness of the Orient, transformed itself from being textual and contemplative into being administrative, economic, and even military. The fundamental change was a spatial and geographical one, or rather it was a change in the quality of geographical and spatial apprehension so far as the Orient was concerned. The centuries-old designation of geographical space to the east of Europe as Oriental was partly political, partly doctrinal, and partly imaginative. It implied no necessary connection between actual experience of the Orient and knowledge of what is Oriental, and certainly Dante and D'Herbelot made no claims about their Oriental ideas, except that they were corroborated by a long, learned, and not existential tradition. But when Lane, Renan, Burton, and the many hundreds of 19th century European travelers and scholars discuss the Orient, we can immediately note a far more intimate and even proprietary attitude towards the Orient and things Oriental. In the classical and often temporally remote form in which it was reconstructed by the Orientalist, in the precisely actual form in which the modern Orient was lived in, studied, or imagined, the geographical space of the Orient was penetrated, worked over, taken hold of. The cumulative effect of decades of so sovereign a Western handling turned the Orient from alien into colonial space. What was important in the latter 19th century was not whether the West had penetrated and possessed the Orient, but rather how the British and French felt that they had done it. The British writer on the Orient, and even more so the British colonial administrator, was dealing with territory about which there could be no doubt that English power was truly in the ascendant, even if the natives were, on the face of it, attracted to France and French modes of thought. So far as the actual space of the Orient was concerned, however, England was really there, France was not, except as a flighty temptress of the Oriental yokels. There is no better indication of this qualitative difference in spatial attitudes than to look at what Lord Cromer had to say on the subject, one that was especially dear to his heart. The reasons why French civilization presents a special degree of attraction to Asiatics and Levantines are plain. It is, as a matter of fact, more attractive than the civilizations of England and Germany, and moreover, it is more easy of imitation. Compare the undemonstrative, shy Englishman, with his social exclusiveness and insular habits, with the vivacious and cosmopolitan Frenchman, who does not know what the word shyness means, and who in 10 minutes is apparently on terms of intimate friendship with any casual acquaintance he may chance to make. The semi-educated Oriental does not recognize that the former has, at all events, the merit of sincerity, whilst the latter is often merely acting a part. He looks coldly on the Englishman and rushes into the arms of the Frenchman. The sexual innuendos develop more or less naturally thereafter. The Frenchman is all smiles, wit, grace, and fashion. The Englishman is plodding, industrious, Baconian, precise. Cromer's case is, of course, based on British solidity as opposed to a French seductiveness without any real presence in Egyptian reality. "Can it be any matter for surprise?" Cromer continues. that the Egyptian, with his light intellectual ballast, fails to see that some fallacy often lies at the bottom of the Frenchman's reasoning, or that he prefers the rather superficial brilliancy of the Frenchman to the plodding, unattractive industry of the Englishman or the German. Look again at the theoretical perfection of French administrative systems, at their elaborate detail, and at the provision which is apparently made to meet every possible contingency which may arise. Compare these features with the Englishman's practical systems, which lay down rules as to a few main points and leave a mass of detail to individual discretion. The half-educated Egyptian naturally prefers the Frenchman's system, for it is, to all outward appearance, more perfect and more easy of application. He fails, moreover, to see that the Englishman desires to elaborate a system which will suit the facts with which he has to deal, whereas the main objection to applying French administrative procedures to Egypt is that the facts have but too often to conform to the ready-made system. Since there is a real British presence in Egypt, and since that presence, according to Cromer, is there not so much to train the Egyptian's mind as to form his character, it follows, therefore, that the ephemeral attractions of the French are those of a pretty damsel with somewhat artificial charms, whereas those of the British belong to a sober, elderly matron of perhaps somewhat greater moral worth, but of less pleasing outward appearance. Underlying Cromer's contrast between the solid British nanny and the French coquette is the sheer privilege of British emplacement in the Orient. The facts with which he, the Englishman, has to deal are altogether more complex and interesting, by virtue of their possession by England, than anything the mercurial French could point to. 2 years after the publication of his Modern Egypt, 1908, Cromer expatiated philosophically in Ancient and Modern Imperialism. Compared with Roman imperialism, with its frankly assimilationist, exploitative, and repressive policies, British imperialism seems to Cromer to be preferable, if somewhat more wishy-washy. On certain points, however, the British were clear enough, even if, after a rather dim, slipshod, but characteristically Anglo-Saxon fashion, their empire seemed undecided between one of two bases, an extensive military occupation, or the principle of nationality for subject races. But this indecision was academic, finally, for in practice, Cromer and Britain itself had opted against the principle of nationality. And then, there were other things to be noted. One point was that the empire was not going to be given up. Another was that intermarriage between natives and English men and women was undesirable. Third, and most important, I think, Cromer conceived of British imperial presence in the eastern colonies as having had a lasting, not to say cataclysmic, effect on the minds and societies of the East. His metaphor for expressing this effect is almost theological, so powerful in Cromer's mind was the idea of Western penetration of Oriental expanses. The country, he says, over which the breath of the West, heavily charged with scientific thought, has once passed, and has, in passing, left an enduring mark, can never be the same as it was before. In such respects as these, nonetheless, Cromer's was far from an original intelligence. What he saw and how he expressed it were common currency among his colleagues both in the imperial establishment and in the intellectual community. This consensus is notably true in the case of Cromer's vice-regal colleagues, Curzon, Swettenham, and Lagarde. Lord Curzon in particular always spoke the imperial lingua franca, and more obtrusively even than Cromer, he delineated the relationship between Britain and the Orient in terms of possession, in terms of a large geographical space wholly owned by an efficient colonial master. For him, he said on one occasion, the empire was not an object of ambition, but first and foremost, a great historical and political and sociological fact. In 1909, he reminded delegates to the Imperial Press Conference meeting at Oxford that, "We train here and we send out to you your governors and administrators and judges, your teachers and preachers and lawyers." And this almost pedagogical view of empire had, for Curzon, a specific setting in Asia, which, as he once put it, made one pause and think. "I sometimes like to picture to myself this great imperial fabric as a huge structure like some Tennysonian palace of art, of which the foundations are in this country, where they have been laid and must be maintained by British hands, but of which the colonies are the pillars, and high above all floats the vastness of an Asiatic dome." With such a Tennysonian palace of art in mind, Curzon and Cromer were enthusiastic members together of a departmental committee formed in 1909 to press for the creation of a school of Oriental studies. Aside from remarking wistfully that had he known the vernacular he would have been helped during his famine tours in India, Curzon argued for Oriental studies as part of the British responsibility to the Orient. On September 27, 1909, he told the House of Lords that "Our familiarity, not merely with the languages of the people of the East, but with their customs, their feelings, their traditions, their history and religion, our capacity to understand what may be called the genius of the East, is the sole basis upon which we are likely to be able to maintain in the future the position we have won, and no step that can be taken to strengthen that position can be considered undeserving of the attention of His Majesty's government or of a debate in the House of Lords." At a Mansion House conference on the subject 5 years later, Curzon finally dotted the I's. Oriental studies were no intellectual luxury. They were, he said, "a great imperial obligation. In my view, the creation of a school of Oriental studies, later to become the London University School of Oriental and African Studies, like this in London, is part of the necessary furniture of empire. Those of us who, in one way or another, have spent a number of years in the East, who regard that as the happiest portion of our lives, and who think that the work that we did there, be it great or small, was the highest responsibility that can be placed upon the shoulders of Englishmen, feel that there is a gap in our national equipment which ought emphatically to be filled, and that those in the City of London who, by financial support or by any other form of active and practical assistance, take their part in filling that gap, will be rendering a patriotic duty to the empire and promoting the cause and goodwill among mankind." To a very great extent, Curzon's ideas about Oriental studies derive logically from a good century of British utilitarian administration of and philosophy about the eastern colonies. The influence of Bentham and the Mills on British rule in the Orient, and India particularly, was considerable, and was effective in doing away with too much regulation and innovation. Instead, as Eric Stokes has convincingly shown, utilitarianism combined with the legacies of liberalism and evangelicalism as philosophies of British rule in the East stressed the rational importance of a strong executive armed with various legal and penal codes, a system of doctrines on such matters as frontiers and land rents, and everywhere an irreducible supervisory imperial authority. The cornerstone of the whole system was a constantly refined knowledge of the Orient, so that as traditional societies hastened forward and became modern commercial societies, there would be no loss of paternal British control, and no loss of revenue either. However, when Curzon referred somewhat inelegantly to Oriental studies as the necessary furniture of empire, he was putting into a static image the transactions by which Englishmen and natives conducted their business and kept their places. From the days of Sir William Jones, the Orient had been both what Britain ruled and what Britain knew about it, the coincidence between geography, knowledge, and power, with Britain always in the master's place, was complete. To have said, as Curzon once did, that the East is a university in which the scholar never takes his degree was another way of saying that the East required one's presence there more or less forever. But then there were the other European powers, France and Russia among them, that made the British presence always a, perhaps marginally, threatened one. Curzon was certainly aware that all the major Western powers felt towards the world as Britain did. The transformation of geography from dull and pedantic, Curzon's phrase for what had now dropped out of geography as an academic subject, into the most cosmopolitan of all sciences, argued exactly that new Western and widespread predilection. Not for nothing did Curzon in 1912 tell the Geographical Society, of which he was president, that an absolute revolution has occurred, not merely in the manner and methods of teaching geography, but in the estimation in which it is held by public opinion. Nowadays, we regard geographical knowledge as an essential part of knowledge in general. By the aid of geography, and in no other way, do we understand the action of great natural forces, the distribution of population, the growth of commerce, the expansion of frontiers, the development of states, the splendid achievements of human energy in its various manifestations. We recognize geography as the handmaid of history. Geography, too, is a sister science to economics and politics. And to any of us who have attempted to study geography, it is known that the moment you diverge from the geographical field, you find yourself crossing the frontiers of geology, zoology, ethnology, chemistry, physics, and almost all the kindred sciences. Therefore, we are justified in saying that geography is one of the first and foremost of the sciences, that it is part of the equipment that is necessary for a proper conception of citizenship, and is an indispensable adjunct to the production of a public man. Geography was essentially the material underpinning for knowledge about the Orient. All the latent and unchanging characteristics of the Orient stood upon, were rooted in, its geography. Thus, on the one hand, the geographical Orient nourished its inhabitants, guaranteed their characteristics, and defined their specificity. On the other hand, the geographical Orient solicited the West's attention, even as, by one of those paradoxes revealed so frequently by organized knowledge, East was East and West was West. The cosmopolitanism of geography was, in Curzon's mind, its universal importance to the whole of the West, whose relationship to the rest of the world was one of frank covetousness. Yet geographical appetite could also take on the moral neutrality of an epistemological impulse to find out, to settle upon, to uncover, as when, in Heart of Darkness, Marlowe confesses to having a passion for maps. I would look for hours at South America, or Africa, or Australia, and lose myself in all the glories of exploration. At that time there were many blank spaces on the earth, and when I saw one that looked particularly inviting on a map, but they all look that, I would put my finger on it and say, "When I grow up, I will go there." 70 years or so before Marlowe said this, it did not trouble Lamartine that what on a map was a blank space was inhabited by natives, nor, theoretically, had there been any reservation in the mind of Emmer de Vatel, the Swiss-Prussian authority on international law, when, in 1758, he invited European states to take possession of territory inhabited only by mere wandering tribes. The important thing was to dignify simple conquest with an idea, to turn the appetite for more geographical space into a theory about the special relationship between geography on the one hand and civilized or uncivilized peoples on the other. But to these rationalizations, there was also a distinctively French contribution. By the end of the 19th century, political and intellectual circumstances coincided sufficiently in France to make geography and geographical speculation, in both senses of that word, an attractive national pastime. The general climate of opinion in Europe was propitious. Certainly, the successes of British imperialism spoke loudly enough for themselves. However, Britain always seemed to France and to French thinkers on the subject to block even a relatively successful French imperial role in the Orient. Before the Franco-Prussian War, there was a good deal of wishful political thinking about the Orient, and it was not confined to poets and novelists. Here, for instance, is Saint-Marc Girardin writing in the Revue des Deux Mondes on March 15, 1862. La France a beaucoup à faire en Orient, parce que l'Orient attend beaucoup d'elle. Il lui demande même plus qu'elle ne peut faire. Il lui remettrait volontiers le soin entier de son avenir, ce qui serait pour la France et pour l'Orient un grand danger. Pour la France, parce que disposée à prendre en main la cause des populations souffrantes, elle se charge le plus souvent de plus d'obligations qu'elle n'en peut remplir. Pour l'Orient, parce que tout peuple qui attend sa destinée de l'étranger n'a jamais qu'une condition précaire et qu'il n'y a de salut pour les nations que celui qu'elles se font elles-mêmes. Of such views as this, Disraeli would doubtless have said, as he often did, that France had only sentimental interests in Syria, which is the Orient of which Girardin was writing. The fiction of population souffrante had of course been used by Napoleon when he appealed to the Egyptians on their behalf against the Turks and for Islam. During the 30s, 40s, 50s, and 60s, the suffering populations of the Orient were limited to the Christian minorities in Syria. And there was no record of L'Orient appealing to France for its salvation. It would have been altogether more truthful to say that Britain stood in France's way in the Orient, for even if France genuinely felt a sense of obligation to the Orient, and there were some Frenchmen who did, there was very little France could do to get between Britain and the huge landmass it commanded from India to the Mediterranean. Among the most remarkable consequences of the War of 1870 in France were a tremendous efflorescence of geographical societies and a powerfully renewed demand for territorial acquisition. At the end of 1871, the Société de Géographie de Paris declared itself no longer confined to scientific speculation. It urged the citizenry not to forget that our former preponderance was contested from the day we ceased to compete in the conquests of civilization over barbarism. Guillaume de Pin, a leader of what has come to be called the geographical movement, asserted in 1881 that during the 1870 war, it was the schoolmaster who triumphed, meaning that the real triumphs were those of Prussian scientific geography over French strategic sloppiness. The government's Journal Officiel sponsored issue after issue centered on the virtues and profits of geographical exploration and colonial adventure. A citizen could learn in one issue from de Lesseps of the opportunities in Africa, and from Garnier of the exploration of the Blue River. Scientific geography soon gave way to commercial geography, as the connection between national pride in scientific and civilizational achievement and the fairly rudimentary profit motive was urged to be channeled into support for colonial acquisition. In the words of one enthusiast, "The geographical societies are formed to break the fatal charm that holds us enchained to our shores." In aid of this liberating quest, all sorts of schemes were spun out, including the enlisting of Jules Verne, whose unbelievable success, as it was called, ostensibly displayed the scientific mind at a very high peak of ratiocination, to head a round-the-world campaign of scientific exploration, and a plan for creating a vast new sea just south of the North African coast, as well as a project for binding Algeria to Senegal by railroad, a ribbon of steel, as the projectors called it. Much of the expansionist fervor in France during the last third of the 19th century was generated out of an explicit wish to compensate for the Prussian victory in 1870 to 1871, and, no less important, the desire to match British imperial achievements. So powerful was the latter desire, and out of so long a tradition of Anglo-French rivalry in the Orient did it derive, that France seemed literally haunted by Britain, anxious in all things connected with the Orient to catch up with and emulate the British. When, in the late 1870s, the Société Académique Indochinoise reformulated its goals, it found it important to bring Indochina into the domain of Orientalism. Why? In order to turn Cochin China into a French India. The absence of substantial colonial holdings was blamed by military men for that combination of military and commercial weakness in the war with Prussia. To say nothing of long-standing and pronounced colonial inferiority compared with Britain. The power of expansion of the Western races, argued a leading geographer, La Rancière Le Nourry, its superior causes, its elements, its influences on human destinies, will be a beautiful study for future historians. Yet only if the white races indulged their taste for voyaging, a mark of their intellectual supremacy, could colonial expansion occur. From such theses as this came the commonly held view of the Orient as a geographical space to be cultivated, harvested, and guarded. The images of agricultural care for and those of frank sexual attention to the Orient proliferated accordingly. Here is a typical effusion by Gabriel Charme, writing in 1880. On that day when we shall be no longer in the Orient, and when other great European powers will be there, all will be at an end for our commerce in the Mediterranean, for our future in Asia, for the traffic of our southern ports. One of the most fruitful sources of our national wealth will be dried up. Another thinker, Le Roy Beaulieu, elaborated this philosophy still further. A society colonizes, when itself having reached a high degree of maturity and of strength, it procreates, it protects, it places in good conditions of development, and it brings to virility a new society to which it has given birth. Colonization is one of the most complex and delicate phenomena of social physiology. This equation of self-reproduction with colonization led Le Roy Beaulieu to the somewhat sinister idea that whatever is lively in a modern society is magnified by this pouring out of its exuberant activity on the outside. Therefore, he said, colonization is the expansive force of a people. It is its power of reproduction. It is its enlargement and its multiplication through space. It is the subjection of the universe, or a vast part of it, to that people's language, customs, ideas, and laws. The point here is that the space of weaker or underdeveloped regions like the Orient was viewed as something inviting French interest, penetration, insemination, in short, colonization. Geographical conceptions, literally and figuratively, did away with the discrete entities held in by borders and frontiers. No less than entrepreneurial visionaries like de Lesseps, whose plan was to liberate the Orient and the Occident from their geographical bonds, French scholars, administrators, geographers, and commercial agents poured out their exuberant activity onto the fairly supine, feminine Orient. There were the geographical societies, whose number and membership outdid those of all Europe by a factor of two. There were such powerful organizations as the Comité de l'Asie Française and the Comité d'Orient. There were the learned societies, chief among them the Société Asiatique, with its organization and membership firmly embedded in the universities, the institutes, and the government. Each in its own way made French interests in the Orient more real, more substantial. Almost an entire century of what now seemed passive study of the Orient had had to end, as France faced up to its transnational responsibilities during the last two decades of the 19th century. In the only part of the Orient where British and French interests literally overlapped, the territory of the now hopelessly ill Ottoman Empire, the two antagonists managed their conflict with an almost perfect and characteristic consistency. Britain was